Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Welcome back, everybody, to the very latest Motorsport Magazine podcast. The biggest and the best podcast for the more discerning motor racing enthusiast. And this week, we move from the oldest team principal in the Formula One paddock to the youngest. You'll have enjoyed, we know how much you enjoyed the last one with Patrick Head, 5 decades in Formula One racing. And today we are at the headquarters of Red Bull Racing with the team principal, Christian Horner, the youngest principal in the paddock, less than a decade in the business thus far, the Grand Prix business anyway. And there's a touch of World Cup fever in the air. Yes, I'm sorry, there is. But don't worry, this is the first motor racing podcast to formally ban the Vuvuzela. So this podcast will not sound as if it's been recorded in a sawmill. Today we're at the scene, of course, of a shock result. Austria 1, Germany 0. And we will probably mention this to Christian a little later in the show. This happened in Turkey, of course, in case you've been living in a cave. And he surely is the man most fed up with discussing that particular moment, but he'll have just one more chance today. I'm going to get the ball rolling before we bring in our editor-in-chief, Nigel Roebuck, and our roving reporter, Ed Foster. Christian, as of today, how do you assess the gap to McLaren?
It's an interesting one. I think that certainly the last race in Montreal, they were a lot closer, if not fraction ahead of us. We expected that to be a circuit that flattered the McLaren with a combination of straight-line speed and their fluidic valve or F duct, or whatever you call it, working particularly well for them there. But we were closer to them than we actually expected to be. So we expect a similar pattern this weekend in Valencia. Although we've got our own F duct or the latest iterative to try on Friday, and hopefully we can push them a little harder this weekend before coming back to circuits that should suit us more with higher speed corners such as Silverstone and Hockenheim, even Budapest.
Bearing in mind that McLaren sort of invented the F-duct, if you like, at least they were the first to have it, how difficult is it to keep? Is it a matter of catching up or not?
It is, because it's a clever piece of technology. Obviously, again, it all comes down to interpretation of rules, and they made a clever design that they incorporated into their chassis, which was deemed to be within the regulations. And once that interpretation is then made, it obviously, similar to the double diffuser, starts a bit of a wild goose chase for other teams to look to introduce onto their car. Probably more complex than the double diffuser in that the ducting that has to run through the chassis, yeah, and the chassis being homologated this year for the first time that you can't actually modify the chassis, has posed some challenges to Adrian and the design guys, but they've as always come up with a fairly ingenious solution to that. So and the results certainly in the test lab have looked very, very encouraging.
I mean, is it a kind of technology that if it wasn't built into the car to start with, you'll never get it as good as someone who's done that? Or
There are compromises you have to take. I understand that the McLaren system is actually built into their chassis. So they've managed to route their ducting and so on perhaps slightly more efficiently than rival teams. But we've come up with quite an elegant solution to the problem. We've taken longer than perhaps others because we've not wanted to become too obsessed with the duct itself and put everything else on hold. So we've tried to keep, with the amount of resource that we have here, we've tried to keep development getting to the car whilst in tandem developing this duct. And certainly once it works, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. Does your F-duct require the driver's hand off the wheel?
Not totally off the wheel.
No, not like Alonso wherever it was.
They don't end up doing the hokey-cokey down the straight or anything like that. But obviously they're using part of their arm on the duct. I mean, the whole debate as to whether the driver was part of the car or not, because it's, is it movable aerodynamics? And because the driver isn't part of the car, therefore he is allowed to operate this valve.
Mm. Right.
You have brought up hokey cokey on the straight, so shall we get something out of the way before we do the rest of this? Has the dust now settled following the incident?
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, obviously a lot was made, and it's ironic because we achieved a 1-2 finish in Monte Carlo 2 weeks earlier, and Mr. Mateschitz spoke to me the following day and said, I don't think we'll ever be able to top that amount of publicity out of a Grand Prix weekend. Little did he know that 2 weeks later we'd go one better. And obviously a great deal has been made of that incident. But it was a result of two very competitive drivers, neither wanting to be beat by the other, that were pushing each other very hard, and they both found themselves in a situation that I don't think neither of them really want to find themselves in. And it was one of those things. Obviously emotions run high on the day, but in very quickly afterwards, we sat down here in Milton Keynes, discussed what had happened, what prevention we can put in place for the future. And very quickly the drivers had put it behind them and were very focused on the next event. And certainly during the Canadian Grand Prix it was business as usual, and working very closely and openly with each other. And whilst they probably won't be spending Christmas together, they continue to work very effectively as a unit.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, okay, let's not dwell on this, but you're actually saying, are you, Christian, that this sort of thing can be put in a box somewhere, can it?
Well, I think it has to be. So both of the drivers recognise that they're contracted to the team to represent the team, and the biggest loser on that day was the team, giving away 28 points. Sure. Plus the points McLaren wouldn't have won. So the net result for the team was disastrous. Mark managed to still achieve a podium. Sebastian ended up on a DNF, and it was obviously valuable points lost for him. But the overall loser was the team, and it was great to see the two drivers, after the meeting, walk around the factory talking to the guys, thanking them for their efforts, and apologising that the incident had happened. So, but they're both professionals. They're both grown-ups, and they've put it behind them and moved on.
Were you taken aback by the response you got from fans at the time, Christian?
I was a little surprised. I think, as with all these things, you can always learn from incidents. And suddenly, as a young team, we've been thrust into the limelight. When everything's going well and you're winning and, achieving 1-2s, it's all pretty plain sailing. I think at that stage, the first time that we'd actually had two drivers, touch and take each other, or certainly one of them retire from the race and happen to be going for the lead of a Grand Prix after what had been a fascinating race. Mm. What particularly annoyed me was that we'd done everything right that day. We'd strategy-wise, pit stop-wise, we'd managed to be ahead of the McLarens. And unfortunately, there was some fairly aggressive journalist approach, one of the consultants of Red Bull Helmut, Marco, who I think made a couple of comments that I'm sure he regrets making in haste, and then out of that obviously a bit of a volcano erupted and the conspiracy theories start and so on. But the most important thing was just to be open and transparent with the drivers, that there was no agenda, there was no hidden agenda, there was no malice or intent. No. But it was quite simply and clearly a racing incident, which they both absolutely 100% accepted.
I think that when the impression I've had from people, just, you know, friends, not in the business, from that weekend, forgetting the actual incident itself, I think that the sort of the fallout afterwards, the main repercussion was that it people said, well, you know, Vettel is the boy, isn't he? He's obviously, because Helmut, I mean, without getting into a sort of battle, I think most people thought it was, if it was anybody's fault, it was Sebastian's, or more Sebastian's, but we won't get into that. But when Helmut said that it was blame Mark, that was what made it, that fostered the impression that, see, we told you, he is the golden boy. He was in the wrong, and yet, and that, but that was the worst legacy of that weekend, I think, that it strengthened the impression that Sebastian is favoured.
Yes, I think, and it's exactly that, it's an impression. I think that, you know, what one has to remember is that Helmut has watched Sebastian since the age of 12 in go-karts, and been instrumental in obviously supporting him through the Red Bull Junior team. And there is, if you like, an affiliation.
Sure.
And a strong friendship between those two. But, you know, he also has a great deal of respect and admiration for Mark. And at no point has either Helmut, and certainly not, Dietrich, ever said, we want this driver to win, or we want the other driver to win. Dietrich's always made it crystal clear to me that, you know, I don't mind if I have the youngest or the oldest world champion, so long as we get one. That's the way we've operated here. You know, if there's, for example, there's two floors this weekend, there'll be one on each car. One arrives on Wednesday, one arrives on Thursday. There'll be no spare. You know, they're both treated with an equal hand, and that's the way, you know, I operate. It's the way that Adrian operates, the way the whole team operates. Obviously, very easy to come to conclusions that the teams wants to favour one driver over the other.
I think it's been more symbolic. I don't think there's ever been any suggestion that, you know, A is favoured over B in terms of equipment. I think that everybody's always accepted that was even-handed. It's more a symbolic thing, I think, than anything else. And probably because Sebastian is so young and going to be around for so long.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Red Bull must hope that he will be, you know, intrinsic to the team for years.
It's a great situation to be in, because it sounds ironic, but we've got a really exciting young driver in Sebastian that has got so much ahead of him. He's a phenomenally talented, intelligent, and capable young driver that is gaining experience with every month that he's operating at this level. And in Mark, I don't think any of us, even he himself, expected to be performing at the level he is this year.
He just gets better and better, doesn't he?
Absolutely. He's like a vintage wine, you know.
He really
is maturing very well.
Yeah. Actually, Patrick Head said he's keeping his eye on him.
Yeah. Ironic when they were prepared to let him go a couple of years ago.
is some of that due to Sebastian pushing him?
I think so. I think they've actually, whilst it didn't happen in Turkey, but I think they've actually bring the best out of each other, in that, you know, for sure it's the biggest challenge that Mark's ever had in his career, and it would have been very easy to roll over and accept a number two rear gunner type role, and in fairness to Mark, he's worked incredibly hard on his own performance, and you know, it's definitely raised his game. You know, certainly in 2008, with David approaching the end of his career, one felt that perhaps Mark's motivation wasn't quite, as hungry as certainly we've seen in the last couple of years. And of course, he had the big accident, going over the 2008-09 winter, and recovered from that tremendously well. So you have, and I think, with lots of drivers, I mean, Nigel, you probably better gauge than me to review this, but quite often when they get a first Grand Prix win, it's almost like a pressure release valve that suddenly they go from thinking they can win to knowing. And there's a big difference between going into a Grand Prix and thinking you can do it, and a big difference between knowing you can do it. And I think Mark went through that barrier in Nürburgring last year. And he's hit a real purple patch in his career.
That was, I thought Monaco, that was as good a win of Monaco as ever I've seen in, in all the years I've been going there.
Yeah, no, I mean,
it was flawless.
His concentration, you know, with all the safety cars and so on, very easy to break your concentration.
Absolutely.
You know, there was a long race, it was just under 2 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was flawless. And, you know, Sebastian also drove a good race there. So it was great to see, you know, the cars finish 1-2 at a track that we've, as a team, have historically struggled at. It's, you know, slow speed corners, tight. Sure. Corners have never been the forte of certainly the RB5 or even the RB4 under the previous regulations. But the guys here, they work tremendously hard with RB6 to say, right, we're going to improve the car in that lower speed area, and made strides over the winter.
I think it's also a matter of interest as we're gradually moving away from the unmentionable at last, is that, you know, we said at the top of the show that you're the youngest team principal in the paddock, and here you are facing what surely must be the most, okay, it's a great situation, but it's a very, very tough situation. Can you identify what is it that you've got? No, I mean, it's an interest. I'm not expecting you to boast about yourself, but I mean, what does it take? That's what interests me, to bring together Adrian Newey, a brilliant young star, an experienced driver, a huge team of people that are around us here. You know, it's a big job, isn't it?
It is a big job, but the basics remain the same as to whether it, you know, when I was running the Arden Formula 3000 team to, obviously, to the Red Bull Racing Formula 1 team, it's all about the people. The people are your biggest asset, and it's getting a group of people, whether it be 15 in a Formula 3000 team or 500 in a Formula 1 team, to share a common goal and objective. And that goal and objective has to be winning. It has to be, and everybody working for each other, whether it's departments, whether it's you know, between the aerodynamicist, the design office, R&D, production, all the way through that process. And of course, Adrian's a key part of what we do here as the conductor, effectively, sure, of the technical team. And with the drivers, you know, I didn't go to university. After I left school, I did a deal with my parents that said I'd take a year out. I'm still on that year out. you know, I was in a fortunate position where I did drive to a reasonably competitive level. And certainly that gave me a different perspective from a driver's perspective. And having driven for good teams and poor teams, to think, well, you know, what is a driver looking for? And that was certainly, you know, helpful. Yeah. Helpful to me, but it's mainly working with people and you know, trying to simplify problems.
Since you started doing the job, what's been the most difficult thing, or what went better than you assumed or hoped it would, and what was infinitely more difficult? Because I mean, it was a hell of a job you took on, and just coming straight into Formula One, running a team.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember when I arrived here in the beginning of 2005, and I arrived back from having been announced to a shocked workforce that you know, this young upstart,
the previous incumbents were gone.
Yeah, I was 31 at the time, I was clearing away their Christmas cards and half-drunk coffee cup with a secretary in tears outside thinking, where on earth do I start? And then most of the factory left at 5 o'clock that evening. So, but, you know, very quickly you work with the people and you identify where the talent is. And what was refreshing to see was a lot of capable people that were here. And it just needed direction, engineering direction, stability, to allow the talent to come to the service. So that was rewarding to see, you know, the group really come to fruition and work as a group and start to have belief in them, in themselves. Obviously, the politics in Formula One are complex, and sure. I came in at a time when the height of the GPMA and and the FIA and FOM, Ferrari, those times, you know, were working very closely together, and GPMA were off to do something else. So it was a highly political time as well. And I remember the first meeting I attended with the likes of, even Eddie was about in those days, Ron Dennis, Flavio, Jean Todt, and it was complete chaos. And you read about all of these meetings and so on, and you know, got four or five very strong opinions in there. And I came out of it and I wondered what on earth we'd actually all agreed to, because it wasn't clear to me. But everybody seemed to agree that it had been a good meeting.
That's a very honest appraisal of it, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's a good question from Nigel, because, you know, clearly it's been a success thus far, hasn't it, let's be honest. Was there ever a temptation? Did you ever think that you'd like to take Arden into Grand Prix racing? Or, you know, would that have been, was that ever a thought?
I think I'd reached the stage at the end of 2000, or middle of 2004, where the Arden team had won in Formula 3000 in 2002, in 2003, and then again in 2004. And at that stage, I was representing the Formula 3000 teams with FOM, trying to improve the spectacle, and at that point there was already discussions about what was going to become GP2. And Bernie, who I've always had a good relationship with, encouraged me to go and speak with Eddie Jordan, because Eddie was, I think he'd sort of grown tired of Formula One and was keen to exit. And so I went, I had a look, and had various discussions with Eddie, and it was at that point that because I'd been running Vitantonio Liuzzi in Formula 3000, again working with Helmut Marko, who was running the Young Junior program at that stage, that I explained my plans to him, and he suggested I come along and have a chat with Dietrich. And so you know, I did that, and we had a brief chat about Jordan, which wasn't particularly attractive to Red Bull at that time. So I went off and pursued looking into that option, which quickly became evident was unrealistic.
Taking over Jordan?
Yes. Because you have got a quantum leap between, you know, the sort of higher echelons of the lower formulas and Formula One. It was a significant step. And then, you know, Dietrich, I think, decided that he wanted to change the structure and the operational management structure at Red Bull Racing. And at the end of 2004, Helmut gave me a call and said that, you know, Dietrich would like to have a chat. And within 20 minutes of a discussion, you know, we'd agreed a deal. He'd appointed me and given me a budget.
Jesus.
And it all moved very, very quickly. But, you know, I'm tremendously lucky that I've had, you know, Red Bull support, in particular Dietrich support, to, and the freedom to go about building a team here, and bringing the right people in.
Yeah, I mean, talking about bringing the right people in, obviously Adrian Newey has always given, you know, a lot of the credit for the, you know, the speed of the car and things like that. I mean, there's obviously a huge team of people that he's guiding, but
yes.
I mean, are the sort of particular other people in particular that you think have sort of contributed as much as?
Oh, absolutely, across different areas of the business. I mean, undoubtedly Adrian's influence, drive and passion, despite the longevity of his career, and he's still relatively young. I mean, he's only, you know, just over 50, so it's not like he's a dinosaur. Other than that, he's the only guy in the organisation that doesn't turn a computer on.
No, no, no.
Obviously, I mean, and the great thing about Adrian, he is totally open to ideas and innovation. So a lot of the guys that we have here have really flourished under his leadership. We appointed Peter Prodromo, who joined us from McLaren as head of aerodynamics. He's a very, very capable leader and aerodynamicist, done a great job in supporting Adrian. Rob Marshall joined us from Renault, who created the Mass Dampo as one of his babies.
Yeah.
as chief designer. And then throughout the different technical departments, we've made some strategic key appointments about 2 or 3 years ago that have all worked tremendously well, whether it's, you know, again, the Kenny Handcammers as chief mechanic, who joined us from, you know, almost a lifetime at Benetton and Tolman, or Jonathan Wheatley as team manager, the race engineers, Sebastian's engineer, for example, Rocky, I recruited from Newman Haas, someone I looked to get hold of even back in Formula 3000 days. So we assembled a good group of people combined with what was already here. Of course, it's a little bit like a football team, that if you have lots of good individual players, doesn't necessarily mean they're going to play as a team.
No. Are you referring to any particular football team?
Well, there's a couple you can think about at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, is Fabio's job under threat, Mr. Horner? Or are you still loving motor racing?
No, I don't know anything about football. And I think it took 12 months for that group really to settle down, to, because we weren't ready for Adrian. When Adrian first joined us, he'd gone to teams such as McLaren and Williams, which were well-established teams, had tremendous technical infrastructures, but lacked the technical direction. When Adrian came here, it was literally, you've got a long way to go in a lot of areas to be able to really make the use and the best of him. But that was what appealed in the challenge to Adrian, starting with a clean sheet of paper and something fresh and new, and being part of building that. And he's, you know, he and I work very closely together.
How difficult in the first place was it to persuade Adrian to?
Well, I didn't know Adrian particularly well before I came into Formula One. I obviously knew who he was and read a lot about him, but I sensed that he was inquisitive, because at Barcelona, Red Bull, at our first European Grand Prix, turned up with a new structure right next door to McLaren, which were making lots of noise compared to the more corporate sedateness of McLaren. And we were fairly noisy neighbours, and I think it intrigued him that this energy station had pissed Ron Dennis off, so he better come and have a look. And
because in fact, I mean, he had made the switch once already, hadn't he?
Yes,
he'd gone to Jaguar with Bobby Rahal.
Exactly, clearly like Milton Keynes, and it was Milton Keynes that was calling. So I met him in Barcelona, and I just sensed, you know, we got on pretty well, even from the very beginning, with both Adrian and his wife. And, you know, we met again in Monaco and around the Canadian Grand Prix. And it was after Canada that I spoke with Dietrich, and I said, I really sense that Adrian is not totally happy where he is. And, you know, I think there might be a chance we might be able to attract him. And he said, yes, go for it. So, we managed to persuade him to join us in Austria at the end of the season. He wanted to come and learn a little bit more about Red Bull. And we stuck him in an Alpha jet that he went at 500 miles an hour inverted over Innsbruck. It was our highest speed, speeding ticket he's ever had. And he just liked the feel of what Red Bull stood for, and it was a very straightforward decision,
right.
From there. But which I don't think went down particularly well in Woking, but
no.
And of course nobody believed when I initially said Adrian was coming here, the rumour mill started, because they had the announcement. A lot of people have been here in the Jaguar days when it was announced that Adrian was coming here. So there was great relief when they saw him walk through the front door.
That's a great story, isn't it? I mean, it sounds to me a bit as though Mr. Mateschitz is rather good to work for, in the sense that if he wants to do something, he says, fine, do it, or if he doesn't, you don't, or it all doesn't take too long, is that right? I mean, it sounds pretty
dark. Absolutely. I mean, he's, he's demanding, he has clear objectives, he's ambitious, as he has been within the Red Bull business, but he's The great thing about Red Bull is that, you know, I report to him, so if there's a decision needed, it's one person, whether it be drivers, engines, yeah. You know, technical appointments, and he has empowered, you know, us here to go away and build a team, and has been tremendously supportive. And even, you know, in 2007, 2008, when you know, we were showing potential but the results weren't quite there, it would have been very easy to shake things up at that stage, but he, you know, he stuck with it and had the belief. And when the new regulations came along, it was a perfect opportunity to grab a hold of them and demonstrate what the group can do. And you know, I think we've demonstrated that last year wasn't a lucky punch, and that Red Bull is now considered as a, you know, as a front run, as a, yeah, an established front running team.
I think the extraordinary thing about Matichitz is how far he's come in so short a time. And because, you know, Gerhard told me this tale at the Austrian Grand Prix in 85, which was only Gerhard's second year. And he suddenly got this call out of the blue from this guy saying, "I want to sponsor you just in the Austrian Grand Prix." And Gerhard said, "Sure." And the guy said, "But unfortunately, I haven't got any money." And that was Dee Matichitz.
Yes.
That's 25 years ago. And now you look what Red Bull is. He must be a remarkable man.
He is a remarkable man. He's got remarkable vision.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And for somebody that has achieved so much success, he's remarkably down-to-earth, approachable, and normal. You know, it's a pleasure to work, you know, for him. And the great thing about him is he's very passionate. He's very passionate about the sport. He's been a big fan of Formula One since, you know, since his youth. You know, for him, it's not just about marketing. It's not just about advertising. He has a genuine passion for the sport and the history of the sport and what the sport's future will be.
It's good to hear that, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, he will no doubt have been delighted by the being across the front page of every newspaper in every country in the world post. But anyway, I'm sure he appreciated that. I just want to take a couple of readers' questions, if I may, just to interrupt Nigel and Ed for a moment, because and myself. Let's clear up. Have there been or are there any talks about Kimi Raikkonen coming back to Formula One with Red Bull Racing?
Quite honestly, there haven't been. I mean, we're very happy with the lineup that we have. Kimi decided to pursue pastures new in rallying. I think he's enjoying the freedom that that world offers him and driving those cars. And I think for him to return after only 12 months... you know, I don't know. I believe it's his intention to continue in rallying. I think you know, he feels he probably wants to put into practice the lessons that he's learnt from this year.
That's a no, isn't it?
It's a no that we haven't had any discussions about Kimi.
I know, because you obviously are politically adept, so I'm just checking.
Right, okay.
That question came from James. This is a good one for you, I think. It comes from Michel Jobin. And bearing in mind your love of motor racing and the fact that you go to the take part in the Goodwood Revival, which I, you know, endears me you to me, I must say. If you had to hire two drivers from the past, give you a moment to think about it, who would they be and why? Do you want to think about it and I'll come back to it?
Yes, go on. No, I think I can answer that. Right. No, I think the two that I would employ would have been a childhood, you know, or two childhood heroes, which would have been Ayrton Senna and Nigel Mansell. It would probably been a fairly tempestuous pairing.
You could handle it.
And you think you have problems with Sebastian.
Exactly, exactly. You know, if for a penny, but they were both drivers that you know, I tremendously admired as a youngster, watching them. And it would have been fascinating to see them in the same equipment going head-to-head.
That is a very satisfactory answer. You're obviously
Boy, would they have gone head-to-head as well, can you imagine?
You're obviously a glutton for punishment. If you think you've got hokey-cokey now, mate. Anyway, that's a good answer. Just to clarify, by the way, Christian Horner does take part in historic motor racing. He's a regular guest with Lord March at the Goodwood Revival. And this is very nice to see from somebody in Formula One, in my view. And, of course, his technical director, if that's the right title, Adrian Newey, also competes in historic racing, as we know. Can we clear up another thing while we're on that, actually? Which is that does Adrian Newey use the facilities of Red Bull to make it? Okay, just a moment. Oh, you know what's coming.
Well, I know what's coming. I've had this question asked a million times whenever I'm at Goodwood. You know, they claim that it's E-types, you know, that there's special components that have been made. And I can categorically assure you that neither is E-type or GT40 has never been anywhere near this facility. He is obsessive about detail with those cars, as he is with you know, the race cars here, and they're very well prepared, but they're not aerodynamically or mechanically enhanced through the exploits of Red Bull racing. That's for sure.
Good, that's fine. We've cleared that one up, yep, so we don't have to ever talk about that again and ask you another million times. That's all good. Chris Carroll from Sydney in Australia. We have a global audience, you see. he wants to know, and we've sort of slightly covered this, but I'd like a quick answer on it, which is he wants to know whether it is in fact harder to manage two very competitive drivers as now, or motivating two competitive drivers in a slower car, if you're with me. At the moment, you have the best of both worlds, a quick car and quick drivers. As a manager, as a people person, what?
Well, I'm sure both drivers would prefer it if the other was constantly half a second slower. But that, again, isn't a healthy situation for the team. And yes, it does pose bigger challenges when you've got two competitive beasts. But we are fortunate that in Mark and Sebastian, they're both pretty intelligent guys. There's not a Latin red mist that appears. They're both guys that you can sit down and have a grown-up conversation with, which makes life a lot more straightforward. I mean, and dealing with the second part of your question, you know, obviously Mark has spent most of his career not in a race-winning car, and he never really needed somebody to really motivate him. And the only time I started to see his motivation perhaps wane slightly was towards the end of 2008, where he wasn't being challenged by his teammate at that stage. And but you know, very quickly you reset from the very first test that he drove alongside Sebastian, and saw that, you know, 2009 was going to be a much, much bigger challenge for him.
Okay. Yeah, okay. We've just two more listeners, readers, whichever, both questions. Part of our duty here at Motorsport to involve our readers, quite right too. Gordon McCabe, this is a bit long, I'll try and shorten it. Basically, what Gordon's asking is that he felt that perhaps at McLaren, Adrian Newey had felt constrained in some way. How, if you has he been able to have so much more creative freedom, if that's the right phrase, here at Red Bull Racing?
I think Adrian is a little bit like an artist, and that if you constrain creativity, then you don't see the best out of the individual. And, you know, Adrian has a great deal of freedom here.
arguably has more responsibility here than he had at either McLaren or Williams, which he takes, you know, again, very, very seriously.
Right.
But, you know, he, perhaps the environment at McLaren, or, you know, he achieved obviously tremendous things there, is a bit more corporate than here. I doubt he wore jeans and a t-shirt to work at McLaren, where, you know, that sort of de rigueur here. So
I don't think the cleaners wear jeans.
Okay, sorry, yeah. There are lots of them.
Yeah, and you can have a can of Red Bull or a cup of coffee on your desk, or we don't mind what your kids look like. You know, you can have a picture of them on your desk as well. So we're a bit more relaxed. You know, it doesn't mean it's a good thing or a bad thing. No. It's just that we're okay. Different.
But in turn, it allows the man.
And I think he enjoys, you know, the sense of freedom that he's allowed, and that has demonstrated in, you know, the kind of designs that he's still coming up with. It's remarkable that one guy can also generate such a work rate that keeps, you know, pretty much 180 designers absolutely flat out.
180 design 180. Staggering, isn't it?
It is.
Okay.
Well, actually, Christian, what is the total workforce now?
Here we're just over 500.
Right.
Split between design, research, and production.
Right.
Yes, I guess we're probably... We're in the upper echelons of size. We're not a Ferrari or a McLaren.
But it's presumably quite a lot fewer than...
Yes,
used to be.
We're a fair few fewer than we used to be, due to the banning of testing and so on. But the team has had not explosive growth over the years. We've had sort of organic growth, so we haven't had to have mass redundancies to come down to the photo numbers.
Just a final question from our faithful readers, and it's about team orders. And I think it's good to talk about team orders for a few minutes, because A, it's topical, and it seems to never go away, this subject. And it's been in motor racing, Nigel, hasn't it? You know, forever and a day.
Forever and a day.
Forever and a day.
Yeah.
Look, Christian, what is going on? I mean, okay, it is against the rules. Fact. Yes?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's happening. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what constitutes a team order?
Well, to me, it would be someone like you getting on the radio and saying, do this or don't do that.
Yes, but that could be about an engine mode. It could be about a pit stop lap. It could be about could be about anything. Where, I mean, repositioning cars on track, one could translate as a team order. But inevitably, what will happen, and certainly within this team, is that should one driver get himself into a position where he's capable of winning the championship, and the other driver, you know, isn't, either mathematically or practically, then of course that driver, as he would in any other team, will look to play more of a supporting role. But I think there's a big difference between that than where we are at this point of the year, where it'd be wrong to, certainly in our situation, or I believe in a McLaren or even Ferrari situation, to say, well, actually, you have to accept that you're going to play second fiddle to the other driver.
Which any decent racer is not going
to... They're probably not going to listen to
anyway.
Well,
no, that's true, but I mean, that was what Rubens had to endure for years and years at Ferrari. But of course, Rubens' theory at the time was, well, the second Ferrari is better than the first anything else.
Yeah, it's a good point.
You know, I've been offered... To me, that was wholly, totally, completely unacceptable in Austria that day.
Mm. It's a good point, Nigel, because actually the sport could not afford again to have this cruising by on the line like that.
No,
absolutely not.
No.
But I think in a way, though, that the actual writing of a rule is an absurdity, because as Christian says, if it gets to a point in the season when A can win the championship and B can't, of course B should help A.
Yes.
It's not rocket science, it's just common sense, isn't it? So how can you sort of try and write a rule that prevents that?
Well, I mean, Formula One rules are pretty wonky anyway, it seems to me, because, you know, I can't remember a year where somebody... where the rules weren't in some way, had some grey area in them. But I'm quite intrigued by this, you know, again, coming back to managing people, which is what your job's pretty much all about, is what is the inside feeling right down the pit lane about team orders? I mean, you all must have... It's pretty much a question of what you can get away with, isn't it? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as a team, you work as a team. And that if you're HRT or Ferrari, and I've got no doubt, I think even Lotus have probably allowed one of their cars to pass another this year. Mm. Perhaps one had a technical issue or something. Mm. Is that wrong to allow the team to achieve its best result? Right. You know, to ask one driver to let the other go. Perhaps that'll be done or phrased in a slightly different manner. But, you know, both drivers, they wear a set of overalls that carry the team's name. They drive for the team, and the team comes above everything else. I think that people forget that, you know, because obviously a lot of obsession comes about the drivers, but it actually is a team sport. And sometimes, as a team, if circumstances dictate, then inevitably a situation will arise where potentially one driver is given perhaps a better opportunity than the other. But at this stage in the season, certainly for ourselves, perhaps foolhardily we let the drivers race. But we believe that was the right thing to do.
Another point I would make is that I think Ferrari, a couple of times this year when Massa was plainly holding up Alonso.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if we were talking, it is the team that matters. Alonso was obviously capable of going quicker and would have got a better result. So I think Ferrari should have been quite within their rights to say to Massa, let him through.
Yes. I think it's refreshing to see that. I think, you know, times have moved on in Formula One, and the Michael era, as it was at Ferrari, is very different now, and it's great to see McLaren's racing each other. It's great to see Massa beating Alonso, which nobody believed would happen. Or running ahead of him at least two or three Grand Prix earlier this year.
Yeah.
Our drivers race each other. Even Rosberg and Schumacher have gone head to head on occasion. So I think it's just an era of Formula One that perhaps we're moving into. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a lot more healthy.
I mean,
Christian, we're just changing the subject slightly for one second. I'm just interested in that. What is your take on Michael so far?
I think I came back on a flight with Ross Brawn from Formula One Commission meeting yesterday, and saying that it's been actually interesting to see Michael do more racing this year, wheel-to-wheel racing, than probably in his last 3 or 4 years in Formula One. I think for sure... it seems like he's founded a bigger challenge. I think it's very brave for a driver that's achieved everything that he has to come back. And, you know, one has to take the hat off to him and say, well, you know, well done for putting everything you've achieved, on the line to come back. He's still obviously tremendously driven. He has a driving style that, you know, just as a bystander watching, doesn't particularly suit the car that he's in at the moment. No. But he still seems to be driving, you know, very, very, very well and enjoying it. Perhaps he's not, you know, as quick as he was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, but he's certainly still, you know, very, very competitive.
I was going to say, a thing that struck me at Montreal, when I got back to my hotel on Sunday evening, there were some people just checking out, spectators. And they were sort of saying this, asking questions about this and that about the race. And I just said to them, well, it was a good race, you know, did you enjoy it and all the rest of it? And they said, yes, we did, but we are so angry with Michael Schumacher just from the things he did to other people at the corner where we were. So he was doing that all the way around the circuit. And I must confess, I mean, when I saw it, when I watched it on the box when I got back, and I thought, you know, the beast still lurks.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he's nothing like, to me, he's not as quick as he was.
Yes.
And he's plainly, you know, midfield is a new experience for him.
Yes.
But Jesus, one or two of the things he did, you just thought.
You know, he's a ruthless competitor.
Oh, utterly.
And that still shines through.
And gets away with it, as he always did.
One thing that about Red Bull, if I could quickly ask Christian, is and there's a question vaguely about this here from Alistair Warren, which is that do you think it in future Formula One drivers will be always very young superstars like Lewis and Sebastian coming through development programs, whether it be Ron Dennis's personal private development program or whether it be Red Bull, rather than, you know, doing 5 years in a bad car and then eventually winning the world championship? I mean, do you see this trend?
I think that obviously over the years the drivers have tended to get younger and younger, and they're forced to grow up, you know, very quickly now from the point that they leave karting through the different formulae. They can arrive in Formula 1 in the shortest period from karts to Formula 1 in sometimes 4 years, which is remarkably short. And I mean, I think Sebastian was only, you know, 18 years of age when he first sat in a Grand Prix car, which, you know, is very, very young. But the drivers, you know, mature very quickly as well. But I think that there can be no set pattern, because we're a classic example in our team where we've got one driver that, you know, should be in theory just, you know, preparing for his finals, and and another driver, you know, who's 11 years older. With obviously a great deal more experience, and they're both, you know, in tremendous form. I mean, Mark Webber is a bit, little bit Nigel Mansell-esque in that he, you know, it's happened in his career later for him, and you know, he's matured very well as a driver. He makes way less mistakes than he certainly used to earlier in his career, and he's combined speed over a single lap with very strong race performances. So different drivers mature at different rates. I think it's very dangerous to say there's a set rule. The danger is that as more and more investment comes into the youth, is that for those guys that don't make it, you know, looking at Romain Grosjean, for example, a very capable young driver, for sure better than he demonstrated in his few races in Formula 1.
Yeah.
But effectively he's on the... you know, he's on the sidelines now, and it'll be very difficult for him to recover from whereas he would have been better perhaps serving his apprenticeship, you know, after a year in GP2 in a smaller team, learning his trade. And that was the benefit for Sebastian in his sort of first 12 months with Toro Rosso, where the expectation was lower, to learn his trade.
Okay. I mean, do you think the young people coming to the sport are helped a lot by the fact that the cars are perhaps easier to drive than, you know, some of the Formula One cars of the past? You know, they're quite, obviously there's a lot more power, the braking forces, the downforce is a lot higher than all the lower categories, but it's not such a quantum leap as you know, we've seen in the past from something like Formula 2 up to...
No, I think that the lower formulas have improved in terms of the you know, they all drive with two pedals now. Most of the cars have paddle shifts. The higher up you go, certainly by the time you get to GP2, they're running a very similar carbon brake, very similar tyre. Formula 1 extracts more from a driver mentally as well as physically than any other formula, because suddenly you're thrust from a situation where you've been working with one race engineer who's a bit like your big brother, to suddenly you've got a, you know, 20 engineers that all want their individual little bit of analysis, and they're not really interested in what you're doing as a driver. They just want to know, you know, what the tyres or the brakes or the suspension or the aerodynamics are doing. And that's a big difference for a young driver to suddenly get his head around. And some of them are a little bit like rabbits in headlights, and others deal with that, you know, much better. It's interesting to see when we run youngsters how they cope with that environment.
I just wondered whether this ability to do a great many things at once without having to think about it too much is actually the mark of a great driver. I mean, because Ed's saying the cars are easy to drive. Okay, I wouldn't... Yes, maybe they are, I don't know. But they're very technical, aren't they? I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain level, I think that's true, that the cars are relatively driver-friendly. But as across all ages, to get that last percentage, that ultimate amount out of the car, you know, probably to get within a couple of seconds isn't going to be too difficult. To work down from there is tremendously difficult, and especially the tyres are such a big factor, understanding how to get the most out of the tyres. And sometimes we've seen, you know, even between our own drivers, when they hook a lap together, that they can, you know, they can put a reasonable distance between each other. But understanding the tyres is probably the most fundamental thing that the driver has to get his head around.
And the I went to the Porsche driving centre at Silverstone a while ago, and they there's a guy there who did sort of prepare drivers mentally for racing, things like that. And he said one of the reasons why, you know, some of the greats were so good is because they could drive on the limit but using 70% of their brain power. Whereas, you know, there's other drivers that are struggling and they might be using 90%. So someone like Schumacher, if a situation arises, he's still got that much spare to... Yeah. And that's obviously, you know, with all this technology, you can...
Senna and Prost and...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, always like that.
Okay.
It's true.
Can you just explain a tiny bit more? When you talk about understanding the tyres, I mean, maybe I'm stupid, but I don't quite understand what exactly you mean by that.
Well, there's several aspects to it. It's how you prepare the tyre... On an outlap, how you extract the time from the tyre, whether it be under braking, whether it's on the turn in, whether it's on, you know, the traction out of the corner, because sometimes the grip gain isn't just overall, it's specific, and it's specific between the compounds. And then again, the bigger challenge that we have this year in the race is the management of those tyres, ensuring that you don't burn the tyres up or abuse the tyres when the car suddenly got 160 kilos of fuel in. So, and it tends to take, sometimes they'll behave in a different manner. And I think, for sure, you could see with Sebastian in his earlier career on a groove tyre, which I think is more complicated or was more complicated than the current tyre. It took him a little while to get his head around that. But then once he did... You know, he just took off, and you know, that's the biggest thing with the youngsters that tend to come in, is manage to exploit the tyre in the braking phase and all aspects of, you know, of a corner.
It's interesting.
Christian, looking at this season, this post-refueling season, I mean, it seems to me, Bahrain apart, the decision to go the way we have has been completely vindicated. Do you agree? I mean, to me, it's infinitely more interesting.
I agree. I think there's more going on. Yeah. You know, now for the driver, and the driver is a bigger factor than he was in a what tended to be a three-section sprint race.
It was. Yeah.
And exactly. You know, now they've got to really look after the tyre. They've got to, you know, think a great deal more in a Grand Prix. And yes, Bahrain, but didn't lend itself to being a good race.
I think everybody also was being ultra cautious, weren't they? Because it was first time out.
Exactly.
Knew what to expect.
Exactly. But I think, you know, tyres are such a big factor in a Grand Prix now. I mean, I think, as we saw in China, where there was a particularly poor intermediate tyre, the amount of racing that went on was, you know, was phenomenal. The amount of passes that we saw in one race. And again, in Canada 2 weeks ago, we saw you know, a marginal tyre and a reasonable split between the two created, you know, good racing. And it made the aerodynamic impact secondary to that of the, you know, tyre grip.
Sure. And plus the other thing about Canada, what everybody was saying afterwards was, you know, see, take them to a decent circuit and you get a race.
Yes.
And that's, you know, everybody was so glad to be back in Montreal, weren't they?
It was fantastic.
And it just
to be
felt
there,
like being, this is a proper race. You know, there's nothing artificial about this. It was...
Exactly.
Just a very good feeling that whole weekend.
It's always a good... it always tends to throw up good races.
It does, because it's hard on brakes.
Absolutely. And with the added complication, they'd resurface certain sectors of the circuit that made the tyre wear a little more pronounced than at previous circuits, and that was a key factor in the race. So it was the first time that obviously different strategies have been adopted, and unfortunately it didn't work out for us. We took a bit of a risk.
I thought you'd done the right, with the times you, the places you, yes, had on the grid.
Yes.
I mean, Four Mark was pushed back, unfortunately, yes, but I thought, well, if they've done that, you know.
Yeah, no, I thought Saturday evening tires, we were looking pretty good.
I thought
good.
You were looking extremely
and
good.
I think, yeah, the things that went against us were there was the selection of other hard tyre runners where the likes of Lewis and Jensen were supposed to come out between. Unfortunately, three of them crashed on the first lap. In Hulkenberg, Kobayashi and Petrov.
Yes, that's right.
Then Kubica aborted his run very early, and Michael did.
Yes.
So, of course, all the people that were supposed to come up behind had leapt out the way and gave him a clear run.
Yes, sure.
Which kiboshed our strategy, but...
I think the harder compound, there were more graining problems with those than were expected,
yes,
weren't there, for everybody?
Yes, no, very much,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Very much so. An interesting race, because it could have quite easily gone a very different way, and we'd have been sitting here looking pretty at a track that we knew wasn't going to be our our strongest.
Sure.
Do you ever sit on the pit wall and wish you were out there? Because you were, as you mentioned, a useful racing driver.
Never.
It or not?
Absolutely. And I get better with every year that I retired. How do you find that?
Have you ever driven one of the cars?
Not one of these cars, no.
Don't want to?
No, I don't have. Adrian's actually driving one at Goodwood. He's driving last year's car at Goodwood this year. No, I don't have any burning desire.
Well, as you know, 41's the last chance that you can come back.
Yes.
I hate this bit, but we have to stop. Nigel, Ed and I could be here all day, but Christian Horner can't be. He's got a Formula One team to run, as you know. So I hope you've all enjoyed it as much as we have. Fascinating. Thank you very much. Absolutely excellent. You can see him again on Sunday afternoon on BBC television, probably. Unfortunately, every journalist goes through the following announcement at some point in his or her career. We have an apology to make. Yep. During the podcast with Patrick Head, he mentioned that Mark Hughes had been at the launch of the Virgin Formula One car and had repeated some comments about the car. Well, in fact, Mark Hughes was not at the launch of the Virgin car. So much as we all greatly respect and love Patrick Head, he did lead us very slightly astray there. So Mark Hughes, Motorsport Magazine, apologises for the misleading information. Okay. Well, on we go. We'll be back next month with the next Motorsport Magazine podcast. And by that stage, the World Cup, thank goodness, will be over. And
thank goodness.
And the Vuvuzela will hopefully be a noise of the past. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thank you, Christian. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.